Good morning. Dr. Terihua invited me to come here and talk to the physicists about what we do and what kinds of help we can get from physicists. And I'm especially interested in the latter because we are in the midst of an avalanche of data coming in biology, and people don't know how to deal with it. And so it'll be immense help if we can get physicists roped in and involved in this process. So towards that end, I would like to start telling you, making some disparaging comments which will try to drive you away to begin with, and then I'll start seeking your help. Okay, so I'm shameless in admitting that. And so the first point I want to tell you is that the notion of bioinformatics, which is what my lab does and a lot of people are beginning to gear up to doing in various ways, is to model the flow of information in living systems, so which can be starting from the genome level up to gene sequences and proteins, and beyond that towards cell and towards that to physiology and so forth. So this is the flow of information in living systems. So today, with the influx of all the genomic data, people are beginning to think that there's a finite scope for doing this modeling and trying to build, relate them to physiology at various levels. So this is the scope of what bioinformatics is trying to do. Unfortunately, biologists think of bioinformatics as dealing only with the modeling of the sequences, which is going from, once you get a genome, you want to parse the genome sequence into genes, try to find what their function is and annotate the function and try to figure out mechanistically what they do. So this is, of course, the domain of biologists. And physicists, on the other hand, worry about modeling the top-down physiology models at various levels. And what they do is to, in fact, one of the most successful stories of physics dealing with biology is the Hodgkin-Huxley model, which essentially takes a cell as a whole and tries to model it using equivalent circuits. And it's a spectacular way of doing things. And except that, the caveat being, analytical models starting from, equations of various kinds, equations of state and equations of motion and so forth, are very good for modeling things at a gross scale, but when you come to worry about modeling individual details, those things fail miserably. So this is where I would like to talk today about the bridge between going from these two different things and talk about a different concept, the concept of modeling data prior to getting to equations of motion and so forth. So this is becoming emerging as a new paradigm in terms of computational modeling. So I'd like to talk to you today about the complications in doing this and so forth. So the first point I would like to make, I would like to say, is there are two paradigm shifts that are happening in modern biology, and in to some extent in modeling biology. One is, the first paradigm shift is, if you look at the way biologists have done business for the last millennium, whatever, so at least till the last 5 years ago, biologists worry about mechanistic biology, which really means, if you get genes, you get proteins, you worry about how these proteins interact with each other, what are the mechanistic details, exact mechanisms, kinetics and thermodynamics of interaction. So this is what biologists worry about. They do experiments, one gene, one protein at a time. There are people who spend their lifetime working on a single protein, single receptor, single gene, and so forth. However, today, due to high throughput biology, thanks to sequencing efforts, thanks to expression profile, microarray technology, proteomics technology, it's not, you can't deal with mechanistic biology or in entering into the realm of functional biology. So we are essentially going from a mechanistic approach towards biology towards functional approach to biology. And this is essentially a systems approach, because here you don't have the luxury of having to worry about individual details of things. You need to worry about what happens at the level of function and relate all the high throughput data to function. So this is one of the regimes where biology is beginning to undergo a dramatic change. And biologists are not able to cope with this for two reasons. One is they're not used to thinking systems. They don't know how to coarse grain. They don't know how to coarse grain import what details need can be eliminated and you can mean field them and so forth. They don't know how to do it. So this is where I think physicists can help immensely. The second thing that they don't know how to deal with is that they don't know how to organize their thought and knowledge. If you worry about, think about mechanistic biology to begin with, there's a lot of linguistics, a lot of terminology, just like in every other discipline, people have their own language of describing things. The biologist has a beautiful picture in his or her head, and they can worry, think about the details of how cell signaling happens and so forth. But it's not clear how you can translate that and relate it to concrete data that's coming out from experimental biology. So this organization of this knowledge is a major problem in biology. Those are the two difficult things. Now, in terms of the... Okay, please do.
I mean, but I think biologists have always thought at a functional level. In fact, I think the transition is the exact opposite of the one you're saying, which is that biologists used to think at a functional level, used to try and reduce things to the essential variables, deliberately collected minimal data sets, and that now they're going in the other direction. So yes, they're looking at a systems level. I would argue that a lot of genomics is actually is divorcing function from a systematic approach to biology. And there's this idea that by studying all genes, all proteins, giving them equal weight, and applying some form of magical induction, the answers will come out.
Nobody's saying that. This is typical. What I call this is the Greek straw attack. The Greek straw man attack. You know, you construct a straw man and demolish the straw man. That's fine. That's not what I said. So what I'm saying is, I'm saying biologists, yes, I agree with you that biologists are trying to use genome to trying to reduce things to a point where they can understand things. But this is exactly not the way to do it. The question I'm saying is, biologists, think about, I'm going to illustrate what I'm saying today through large numbers of examples. If you look at cell signaling, which is what I want to talk about, focus on major way today, people have investigated single proteins, G proteins, or adenylyl cyclases or so, spend their lifetime studying how they interact in detailed ways with their neighbors, how they interact with other protein partners, components, and so forth. And this is very good, this is excellent, but this knowledge is now superseded by the fact.
But I think you're setting up a straw man. Yes, there are biologists who devoted their whole lives to individual proteins, but there are lots of biologists.
My colleagues that I've been talking to, I would say that this is certainly a good description of a subset of people,
yes,
who I've spent, yeah, many hours talking to,
right,
who tells me that, right, he spends huge amounts of time studying this one protein and this protein, and the one,
exactly.
And he's looking for somebody else to come in and sort of try to organize.
Absolutely. And I don't blame them. No, it's not. It's a large community. It's a large community. It's not a small community. And the reason is very simple. I actually think it's a laudable thing, what they did. It's laudable simply because there's nothing else you could do in the absence of high-throughput data. I mean, if you want to look at a cell, I mean, how... That genetics, I'm talking about, yeah.
But it just seems like if I said, you know, physicists are, I mean.
Look, I'm not compartmentalizing people. Let's get this straight. I'm not compartmentalizing people. All I'm saying is the approach to biology, I mean, you can say genetists have been trying to look at whole chromosomal stuff. They look at markers, they look at interactions between different elements, response elements, and all this stuff. No questions about that. Nobody is decrying or denying that they did all these things. All I'm saying is they lacked sufficient data and sufficient high-throughput technology to be able to think about a systems approach. And if you disagree with that, then I'm sorry. You know, I mean, I don't, expression profile technology.
I'm not a compromise. I subscribe with the comments.
Yes.
Although I am a regional physicist.
Yes. Right.
I figured out that biology is no stupid. And
no, that's not what I said.
It's my formula.
Yeah.
No, <yours. laughs> They constantly think big.
Yes.
But since you cannot put ends together, it's difficult.
Right.
So they work on specific ends.
Right.
And spend their time,
right,
on the specific ends. It doesn't mean that they have no target to describe.
Absolutely.
The system.
Yeah.
They constantly think about that.
Yes. I agree with you.
Okay, this is a very treacherous subject.
I agree with you. Okay, now that I've antagonized biologists, I'm going to antagonize physicists now. This is my next objective. So in any case, all I'm saying is the amount of high-throughput data that is coming out today from technology, this has happened in the last 5 years to 10 years, and the technology is simply the following. PCR. I mean, sequencing, genome sequencing, gene sequencing, protein sequencing. Expression profile technology, which is essentially asking the question, what are the genes typically expressed in a tissue, for example. and then proteomics technology. This high throughput approaches towards dealing with biology is producing enormous amounts of information. How do we collect all of that and deal with it at a systems level and not worry about the details of exactly how protein kinase A phosphorylates SARC? I mean, this is the question that I'm asking. So if you want to really go beyond this point and talk about how this whole thing's response happens in the cell, that's the question which can be addressed today, and we need some help in doing this. This is all I'm saying. And so I'm saying, think of the cell as a black box. This is your cell. This is your input, and this is your output. And I want to ask a simple question. Today, we have phenomenological models of what is the mapping between the input and output in some cases. But what happens inside here now could not be studied till recently. Even now, it's not completely possible to do that. It could not be studied because of lack of sufficient data as a function of space and time. You know, I mean, it's a function of space and time inside the cell. So all I'm saying is that this kind of an absence of data is why we could not do it so far. What I plan to do today, what my objective of talking to you is actually more to solicit and invite interactions of various kinds between physicists and biologists towards solving some problems that we deal with. So we want to ask the question, what is the phenomenon of signaling, of communication of this input to output? So I want to illustrate for the first half an hour or 45 minutes of my talk, I want to talk about actual biology of how it happens and how biologists think about these issues. And this is based on not my own bias, it's based on what biology textbooks, biology researchers do, how they think about this problem. And then they come back and tell you how we cannot do currently quantification of these things or try to do this use quantitative approaches to analyzing this, given this way of dealing with things. So what I would like to talk about is I want to focus on, I mean, if you take a cell, lots of things are happening in a cell. There's a cell cycle, there's cell metabolism, there is cell signaling. And I want to focus on one aspect. There's all these pathways, which really means that if you have an input, the input is parsed by the cell by lots, hundreds of thousands of proteins doing various things. So I want to focus on one aspect of it, which is called cellular signaling and communication. This is the only thing I want to focus on today. And I want to tell you about one of the largest post-genomic projects that is being undertaken for an analysis of the cell signaling from determining consistent high-throughput data, which will tell us how we can understand cell signaling. So this is what I want to share with you today. So the first part of my talk, I want to talk about, thank you. I would like to talk about what are the mechanisms of intercellular communication. I'm mostly going to focus on intracellular events, but intracellular events are triggered by intercellular communication at the first level. The first step in communication signaling is the formation of a signal in a signal-producing cell as a result of an external trigger. So, for example, it can be stress, it can be temperature, it can be pressure, it can be a chemical, or whatever it is. So, I mean, tell me, this is too elementary. If all of you guys know this very well, I'll skip all of this and talk about more details, okay? Then the second is transport of the signal to the target cell. And today, people can model this, physicists model this, or engineers model this, using diffusion-based approaches. For example, I can use some effective diffusion coefficients or phenomenological equations to say that how can I say what is the level of activity as a consequence of triggering something? Then the third part is registration of the signal in the target cell. The signal actually registers in the target cell. And then it further transmission of the signal into the target cell, and the transformation of the signal into a biochemical or electrical reaction in the target cell. This is again something which physicists have studied before in the past. Hodgkin-Huxley is a good model for this. And the final thing is termination of the signal. Okay? So, and the pathways are characterized by the following features. So if you are modeling this, for example, you need to worry about nature of the triggering signal. How is the signal registered? What is the mechanism of registration of the signal? Mechanism of transmission and termination of the signal, and nature of biochemical reaction induced in the target cell. Each one of this is a very complicated sequence of events and processes which take place in time and space. The question is, how can we model this? To give you a pictorial way of looking at this, the principal mechanisms by which signaling happens, extracellular signaling, I'm talking about cell-cell signaling, cell-to-cell, is through either chemical messengers or gap junctions or cell-cell interactions via surface proteins. So the first process is, here's one cell releases a chemical. The chemical goes and binds to the next cell and triggers an activity. And this happens ubiquitously in the body in various places, including in the brain. The second is gap junctions, which essentially means the two cells have something that connect the two to each other. And so the signal is passed from cell one to cell two, and there's a response in cell two. The third is interactions via surface proteins. There's no communication of material between the two. There's just one protein here talks to next protein here, and then this triggers various events. So these are three well-defined processes by which signal mechanisms happen. Now, the reception of the signal. How is the signal received? So I broke this down into systematically into step one, step two processes. How is the signal received? Cell surface receptors receive the signal. The chemical messenger enters into the target cell and activates the receptor localized in the cytosol or in the nucleus. So essentially, something receives a signal on the top of the surface of the cell. And there's a messenger. Second approach is a messenger enters into the cell and then activates various response elements. Both types of signaling happen in all the cells. I'll give you examples of that in a few minutes. Now, transmission regulation, let's look at the pictorial way of looking at it. Here is your signaling cell. Here's a chemical messenger. It comes out, binds to your receptor, and then in the target cell, lots of things happen, and finally A goes to B. You know, that's the ultimate response, like, for example, transcription regulation. Okay. Now, when we go inside the cell, what are the components of inside the cell? What happens? Now, so far, I've focused on outside the cell. Inside the cell, once this binds to the receptor, the signal binds to the receptor, the receptor, in turn, something happens inside. We'll see how this is where biologists have focused for a long, long time. There are people who have spectacular work on trying to understand what are the changes that happen in the membrane receptor, how is it communicated immediately to inside the cell. And then you have effector molecules, and there are things called adapter molecules that bring effector molecules together. This starts generating lots of intracellular messengers, and this in turn talks to various enzymes and proteins and then gives rise to a response. The best understood part of intracellular communication is this first part, which deals with essentially registering of the signal on the cell. So this is the thing that's well understood. There are books, textbooks written on how physicists can model or engineers can model the binding of ligands and hormones and substrates to extracellular receptor and what happens at that point. So this is the level of understanding where people have quantitative approaches to dealing with it. Now, what are these molecules, these types of molecules that bind? So I'm going to tell you the complications in just a second, how it's difficult to do this. What are these molecules? These molecules can be small organic molecules like hormones, estradiol, testosterone, cortisone, aldosterone. It can be retinoids. It can be all kinds of these small molecules. So a small molecule binds with high specificity to a receptor, and this starts triggering events. Now, what are the complications? The complications are the same molecule can bind to multiple receptors and elicit multiple responses. Do we know what controls that? Not completely. So this is a real significant problem. Now, also, different molecules, different substrates, can bind to the same receptor or different receptors and elicit same response. Okay? So obviously, something that's happening inside is the same response to something that's happening outside, which is different. So we don't have, I'm going to give you two examples of that in a second. Give you an example in a second. Before I do that, let me say one more thing here. There are two types of intracellular signaling that happen. One is that the signal binds, that the hormone binds to, or substrate binds to a receptor outside, and then there's conformational changes here, and then this intracellular signal gets transmitted down here to the nucleus. Various things happen, and then you got response, nuclear transcription response, for example. The second approach, which is very common in hormones, for example, is that the hormone actually enters the cell, and then inside the cell, it has got something in the cytoplasm that receives it and then triggers subsequent things. So it can happen either in the membrane or it can happen go inside. Okay, so these are two well-defined responses to intracellular signaling. I'm going to give you an example of the question that I raised. Variability of the receptor and signal response. There are often many different receptors for a given hormone with similar binding specificity that activate different signaling pathways. Okay, same hormone. In some cases, it'll do something. In some other cases, it'll do probably exactly the opposite thing. For example, in one case, it may trigger the upregulation of a gene. In the other case, it'll trigger a downregulation of a gene.
So
Same cell type and everything. So I'll tell you why. I'll give you examples of that in a minute. So there are subtypes of receptors that differ in their affinity to the hormone. There's not only one same receptor that can elicit different responses, but there's also subtypes of this receptor, which means type 1, type 2, type 3. They can, and their expression in turn is regulated. There's a feedback. Their expression is regulated by what else binds to it. And then they can give rise to a whole set of different slew of pathways. Okay? And example, adrenaline, on an example, here's an example. Adrenaline can initiate cyclic AMP-mediated signal transduction or an IP3-mediated reaction. Same molecule, same substrate. Okay? Also, different receptors and signaling pathways can induce the same biochemical reaction. You can have different receptors, different signaling pathways. Ultimate response is the same. So this is a problem that we don't understand how to deal with this at any great level of detail, what happens inside. Okay? I'm going to talk about that as we go along. Well, I mean, one of the goals of Alliance is also to map out those kinds of things, but I will talk about that in a few minutes. So essentially, you can have this hormone binding to, in the same cell type, it can bind to two different receptors and give rise to responses, which is X and X prime, which are different. Or you can have the hormone binding to two different receptors, or two different hormones binding to two different receptors, which may give rise to the same cellular response. There are many, many examples in cell signaling. I mean, there's still numerous examples which do this. So the point I made here is, once you have an input coming at a cell surface, input, the same input can elicit different responses. Different inputs can elicit the same response. So we need to worry, I mean, ask the question, how do we deal with these issues? What happens inside? So in order to understand that, we need to know what happens inside the cell. So this is what one of the goals of what I'm going to talk about for most of my talk. Now let's talk about first what happens inside the cell. The first step, what happens inside the cell, in many cases, a few molecules of a hormone are sufficient to initiate an enzymatic reaction in the cell in which many substrate molecules are turned over. Dramatic example that you know of is, thank you. Okay, I can focus it a little bit too. Oh, I do have this thing. I didn't know that. Yeah, I didn't know that I had this. I wish I'd known this earlier. I'm kidding. So, I mean, in terms of the amount of signal that is necessary for doing this, you know that you can smell very, very minute quantities of something. And there are pheromones which bind. I mean, very small quantities can elicit responses. Okay. So what happens is, even few molecules of a hormone are sufficient to initiate an enzymatic reaction in a cell. Essentially, a hormone binds here. It activates the receptor. And look at how many different things can happen here. It can bind to large numbers. Yeah, that's the focus. Oh. Is that better?
If there's more thing, I don't think. Okay. Check your fill. We're getting on back.
Okay, I will try to. I don't have too many overheads which have small lettering, so don't worry about it. So when I lift it up a little bit, it'll be better. Okay, so there's what's called amplification of the signal. So the amplification can occur in multiple ways. I'm going to tell you today about at least a few different types of amplification that can happen. The amplification can happen because the receptor, once it is activated, can keep talking continuously till it gets a feedback regulation of some kind, can keep talking and continuing to generate signaling. That's one way to do it. The second way is the amplification can even do one event which can give rise to lots of second messengers, things which are continuing to go inside the cell. It can, for example, a single molecule, single receptor can elicit hundreds of calcium 2 plus, introduction of hundreds of thousands of calcium 2 plus species. And so that way you can have lots of amplification coming in. So there are different types of amplification that come in cells. Do we understand this? Do we know how to deal with this? The answer is, in some cases we do, in most cases we don't. So I'll tell you how we can get data to think about these issues. Now, regulation. So one of the fundamental tenets which physicists understand well, but I mean, and biologists understand well at some level, is regulation, which is that, you know, you've got every single biological event, there's feedback, there's regulation. Now, we don't know how to fit regulation into your model at this point. All the steps, let's talk about the steps for a given case. Biosynthesis of the hormone, which is one cell communicates with the next cell. I mean, simple thing is your testosterone response. You know, I mean, you look at some things, some objects of desire, and your testosterone response. So that how much it is, how long it sustains, and so forth. There's a regulation of that, biosynthesis of the hormone, storage and secretion of the hormone, transport of the hormone, reception of the signal by the receptor, transmission and amplification of the signal inside the cell, and the biochemical reaction of the target cell, and finally degradation and excretion of the hormone. Every one of these are subject to regulation. Okay, which really means that there is something that controls, there's a loop feedback that controls in time and space both, and there's regulation happening in both levels. That's the trigger, the sensory, electrical, other signaling pathways. This is the trigger. This is the biosynthesis, storage, secretion. This, what happens here, can feedback here into this. The signal at the end of this feeds back into this. This is the hormone producing cell. This is the hormone. This is the transport is regulated. The signaling pathways inside are regulated. The response is regulated. And so this regulation is one of the key features of cell signaling. You asked me the question earlier, how can the same hormone induce two different responses and bind to two different cases? Feedback and regulation is one response to that. For example, in one simple case, when this happens, when the initial hormone binds here and starts a signal, you've got a synthesis, you've got generation of a new gene, which goes and which makes the protein, which goes and binds to the receptor and starts binding this with higher affinity. So there's competition for this hormone between two receptors. Okay, so there are mechanisms like that which are involved in this feedback.
In a situation like that, if you had a population of cells all exposed to the same hormone, some fraction of them would start doing one thing, some fraction would start doing another. Maybe that's biologically sensible.
Absolutely, absolutely. This is one of the fundamental questions that, in fact, I want to say one more thing about. You've made a very good point. The ergodic hypothesis in physics, biologists don't really know the answer. We don't know the answer. I think of myself as a biologist. We don't know the answer whether the ergodic hypothesis is valid or not. And we think it will be the only way that cells, when you give an input into your cell, does an average cell behave the same as an average of collections of cells in response? All of our pharmacology or drug targeting is assuming that that's what happens. And we know it doesn't happen that way. Because I'm going to give you one example of chemotaxis before I finish, which actually shows that it is really the collection, the average cell is not the same as an average of cells. But as long as we are in the distribution, in a Boltzmann distribution, where we are addressing the middle of the Boltzmann distribution, we are okay. We still will have tails, which is one of the reasons why diseases persist. We have regeneration and so forth. In any case, this is going outside of what I was going to say at this point in time. Okay, how do cells, let me ask a question. So I'm trying to do this logical progression. There is the signal which comes in the cell receptor. The cell receptor thing does some things, and then it sends it inside, and then there's amplification. What is the mechanism by which what's inside can talk? No, for example, what is inside the cell? How does it know when something registers and it has to come and talk to this membrane, protein or membrane receptor? So this is accomplished by association of signal proteins with a membrane by post-translationally affixed lipid anchors composed of hydrophobic residues like fatty acids. Essentially, imagine the following. This is your cell membrane, and this is your protein here. This is where the hormone binds. And then this has got to talk to guys inside the cell, and they are not always sticking to this thing. So how do they know when to come here and talk to this, and how do they actually accomplish that process? So they get post-translationally modified, which means that this exists already in the cell. And then there's lipid anchors here. They go through either conformational changes or additions of these lipid anchors, and these lipids come and bind to the membrane, and then they can talk to each other through lateral diffusion on the membrane surface. Okay, so this is really a very, another process which says, when are things getting post-translationally modified? Do we have knowledge of this? You know, at this point in time, we have very limited knowledge of post-translational modifications as the time and space events of how this happens. So things like lipid anchors, they can target proteins to the membrane, cytoplasmic region, example. So they need to target things specifically. So not only we are talking about trying to figure out how things happen in time and space, we're trying to figure out the vectorial direction in which things happen. So this adds a dimension of complexity to dealing with signaling. There are many ways to do this. So biophysicists have been doing this using fluorescence techniques, for example. You can ask the question when the lipids get attached to the protein using fluorescence techniques. And they can look at time scales, lifetimes of these things. Then biologically, you can look at today, for example, the way you would do it in high throughput mode is to use mass spec. And one of the things I'm going to cover before end of my talk, in the second half of my talk, deals with how you use mass spec methods in order to understand what is the content of a cell, this level. Again, if you do time-resolved mass spec, which really means you sample at different times, I can ask when is it getting generated, when is it getting processed, when is it getting finished, and so forth. But the point I wanted to make here is there's a vectoriality to this, or there's a vectorial nature to this thing, so you need to ask the question, where is it targeted, where is it going, and if you're thinking about modeling, you need to keep this in your mind. The surface.
Yeah, in the membrane surface. Yeah. Either these membranes or more membranes or cells.
Yeah.
And so as a consequence, a lot of diffusive processes are really happening in two-dimensional, three-dimensional.
Absolutely.
A huge amount of difference with respect to the way the chemistry reacts. So chemistry
this, all the membrane events, cellular membrane events, John's absolutely right, can be modeled assuming them to be two-dimensional processes. Now, there are bioengineers and chemical engineers who work on these problems. There's a book by a guy called Doug Laufenberger, which talks essentially about diffusion of proteins both to a cell surface and interactions in the cell surface as a two-dimensional problem. And one of the complications that John, of course, assumed he knows about this is that there's phase transitions of our higher-order phase transitions of all kinds happening on the lipid, on the membrane surface, which physicists can help in terms of at least thinking about how these things are triggered and so forth. Well, I mean, changes in structure and conformation and so forth, which essentially can be regarded as higher order phase transitions. I mean, there's what's the name of this famous physicist who got a Nobel Prize? His book, in fact, deals with this membrane lipid phase transitions. And what's the guy, French guy, Degenes. Yeah. Degen, yeah, he has his book, in fact, deals with this at great length about talking about phase transitions in cholesterol and lipid systems, and how he has a number of papers now which deals with this issue. And
I've heard about those things, they always have this caveat that there's, of course, no biological relevance because the phase transition doesn't occur in the biological.
Not true. They're induced not by temperature, the variables are different. They're not induced by temperature, they're not induced by pressure. There is pressure, of course, osmotic pressure. They're induced by combinations of chemistry and osmotic pressure that goes on. For example, I mean, when effectors bind to GPCR, G-protein-coupled receptors, you've got changes in the local environment around the lipid. How do we know this? We know this from the detailed biochemistry of people have looked at in terms of, I mean, using optical methods, using surface evanescence methods, using AFM. People have atomic force microscopy. People look at what happens in the vicinity of when these things bind. And there's a clear evidence. I mean, if you're rigorous and define phase, I don't know how to define phase transitions, but the point is there are transitions which can be modeled by effective parameters of kinds. And these are, in fact, one of the papers that I read from Degenes really talks about relaxation of these phenomenon, where you can actually measure relaxation of this phenomenon, and they are stretched exponential relaxation timescales and so forth. So anyway, but the point here is, depending on the local conformational state, I was saying that lipid anchors can also be used to switch. See, this is another fine thing about these anchors. These lipid anchors can be used as a switch in signaling pathways. So they go through, it's like a binary switch. So these lipid anchors attach to proteins post-translationally, they go and stick to the membrane. When they stick on the membrane, they can actually act as a switch, depending on the local conformational state. They can be either solvent exposed or buried, and the switch regulates. One of the regulatory mechanisms is the switch, which goes between one conformation and another conformation. Sorry? Oh, here. So I said that here is how there's a post-translational modification, and this anchors onto the. Once it anchors to the membrane, It has conformational changes. It can go from one state to the next state. For example, it can shut off this machinery, or it can turn it on depending on what interacts with it. For example, the two states are solvent exposed state and buried state, for example. For example, there's a... Exactly. The lipid that's stuck in the membrane can have a portion which is hydrophilic and a hydrophobic portion. If it is a hydrophilic portion is exposed, it acts in one way. If the hydrophobic portion is exposed, it acts in another way. And this can depend on what is the other protein that comes here and attaches to it. If you've got a phospholipase, for example, which comes and attaches to this, and so then it can expose the solvent exposed part, then it can shut off the signaling. Exactly. Both inside and outside, there are both regulation mechanisms. So this is why biology gets so complicated. When I mean, there's too much linguistics in this, in defining this. So here's an example for, let me skip this for a minute, because this is a little bit more complicated than what I want to deal with. Here's a good pictorial example that illustrates what I was saying. It's an example of a real protein called sarcinase. Here's a membrane. So the membrane here binds to this sarcinase. There's glycine, serine, serine, lysine, serine, lysine. These are charged amino acids. Okay, these are basic amino acids, and so these are charged. They're phospholipids, so therefore they got charged here. So there's a charge interaction, and this actually does bind with high specificity. When it binds, it turns on things. The moment you have a change in the proton gradient here, this lysines get the pKa's change. The pKa's change, then it comes off the membrane, and when it comes off the membrane, the event changes. So there's a whole slew of events that take place. Purely by adjusting things like pH gradient, things like calcium, things like sodium. It's not inside the cell. This is outside the cell. We're talking on the surface sometimes. I mean, I'm saying there are... Well, Salk is inside the cell, but the point I'm making is the following. The point I'm making is small changes in pHs. There are pKa's of... There's a pKa of a lysine in an enzyme, which is... Yes.
These are things that are in a relatively unstructured part of the protein. PKa, all these groups can be way above any range which an intracellular pH is going to fit. I mean, sure, it's a poor diagram like that. I mean, it isn't a self run, but it's a diagram.
Correct.
And yes, intracellular pH goes up and down, but it's not going to change the price of these residues to make them charge by anything except the binder extent, unless it's chlorophyll.
Look, all we're trying to find out is, we're trying to find out the following. We're trying to find out, yes, you're, in fact, you made an extremely interesting point. These are pictorial things. We do not know either the structure or the details of what is happening. In fact, a lot of this is based on deduction from experimental biology. All I'm saying is we need to have consistent approaches towards understanding this phenomenon. I'm not disagreeing with you. I mean, I look, you know, we can argue about this offline. I can send you papers or references where people have looked at these things at great length in terms of monitoring changes. Okay, it may not be the specific example of what I'm talking about, the general principles of changes in small things like pH can regulate a lot of individual biochemical events, and which can trigger changes inside the cell. I mean, signaling events inside the cell. Yes, you know, I mean, I'm trying to provide you with a picture of what are all the kinds of events that physicists can think about in terms of modeling. Yes, you know, if you ask me whether I can compute the pKa of each of these proteins, there are ways to compute these things, good, bad, or ugly. There are ways to, for example, okay, so every, good point. See, when you take an acidic or a basic group, you can change your proton concentration, for example, and you can calculate the equilibrium constant for the dissociation of an acidic group. Okay, imagine you have AH, hydrochloric acid. You know, you can change the dissociation constant or association constant if you look at the inverse. You can change it by changing the pH value. pH is actually the concentration of the... Okay. So by changing the pH, you can address the you can measure the equilibrium constant. So essentially, you'll get a titration curve, which says at different values of proton concentration, you'll have you'll have a curve which talks about different states of protonation of the residue. So what he's arguing is that this has got a pKa of this only gets at pH 13 anything above pH 12 or something like that, it's always protonated, so it's not a big issue. That's the point that he's raising. So and he says that, well, I mean, this is unphysical, unreal, and so forth. There are examples in enzymes, for example, where the pKa can go very, very low in lysine, which is totally buried, and so forth. The specific example may not be the case. The point I'm trying to make here is regulation in pH, regulation in concentrations of ions, regulations in concentrations can change, and we know examples of where it changes binding and association at the surface of the membrane. And these things can act as regulators and switches. So that's the point we're making. Sorry?
Where do you see physicists in this picture? You would like a physicist to calculate the changes in the affinity of some protein
Okay, so I mean, currently the type of modeling that people do, biophysicists do, or whatever category of physicists do, is to try to model, for example, the switch. Like I talked about the switch. I mean, there are examples where people can calculate both experimentally measure and computationally calculate the exact pKa's and ask the question, when does dissociation occur? When is the electrostatics changing, delta G of going between the bound state to the unbound state? So those are types of things that physicists do today. Exactly. And people do that. There are, I mean, lots of examples of cases where people have calculated and measured. And they can also, you need that for example, if you're monitoring diffusion using Brownian dynamics, you need to know exactly the electrostatic forces that are operating for association between these two things.
That seems rather like in a direction away from the system.
It is not a systems approach. This is the point. It's not a systems level approach. It is approach of individual things. So when I complete more, you'll see how you want to really go to the systems level and talk about the details of, talk about the overall modeling of the system.
I actually like that. There are a lot of different physicists with a lot of different types of tools.
Yes. Okay, now let me focus a little bit on transmembrane receptors. So the first stage, let's go into some details of what happens transmembrane. The reception of the signal, we have specific binding of the ligand at the outside of the membrane and registering a change in the membrane potential, so that's one thing that can happen. Reception implies activation of the receptor for further signaling. Okay, so further transmission of the signal through membrane, inside of the membrane, there are three possible ways you can think about it. One is, there are three types of receptors. One is ligand-controlled transmembrane receptors. You have a ligand that binds here, changes things inside, and this in turn gives out signals. You have ligand-gated ion channels. So you have this ligand binds here, and then it closes it or opens it, in which case you can ions going back and forth. And you've got voltage-gated channels. And in fact, physicists have studied this a lot, voltage-gated channels. This is where the Hodgkin-Huxley and all associated models come into picture. In terms of producing, essentially, you can look at current voltage relationship with changes in concentrations of ions and concentrations of other species. And that's a systems level approach to modeling. However, what Hodgkin-Huxley cannot do very effectively is, if I have a mutant channel, imagine I have a channel which is defective in some sense, or it's responsible for a disease, I don't know how to model it unless I fudge the parameters in my Hodgkin-Huxley equations. So I don't, for example, the current voltage relationship, if I make a single mutation in a calcium channel, or I can see changes in my current voltage relationships experimentally from electrophysiology, I can't model unless I use parameters which are different. What is going to be possible with the advent of what the future of genomics and bioinformatics is bringing is the ability to actually build this gap between phenomenological modeling and getting parameterizing these things starting from well-defined ab initio models, or first principle approaches. Exactly. Yeah.
Right.
Exactly. Good. And that's not necessarily doable at an analytical level. This is the point I was trying to make in the beginning. And I mean, I said some of this may involve data modeling, which is essentially trying to find out the statistical approaches towards finding out what is happening. So the structural principles of the transmembrane receptors are that you have ligand binding, you have a glycosylation site very often, you have extracellular domain, this is the transmembrane domain, and this is the inside intracellular domain. You can have either enzyme activity, or you can have phosphorylation, or you can have interactions with affected proteins. All these things, or a combination of these things, are possible for the next step of signaling. So it's not just when something binds here, you can have a sequence of all of these events. Now what's another very interesting thing is the second approach, second type of receptor. You can have oligomerization of the receptor in the two-dimensional. This is one of the things that John referred to. You have a receptor, it can move in two dimensions. You can have dimerization or trimerization or tetramerization of these receptors, and they can give rise to different properties. For example, in the normal state, when nothing is associated, it may be in the monomeric state. Okay? The only way a hormone, for example, a growth hormone, can bind to this is when it dimerizes. So the oligomerization may induce the changes, and the state of oligomerization can be regulated by the feedback loop. And it can say when it stops and when it's turned on. You can have also the binding of the hormone can itself trigger oligomerization state. So that's one type of receptor, and we'll talk about briefly about this towards the end of my talk. The third type of receptor deals with through its transmembrane proteins that can interact with proteins through covalent interactions or non-covalent interactions on the membrane surface. So a lot of events happen on the membrane surface. And if we can model this, we model the first step of the signaling event. Here's examples of what membrane proteins look like. These are X-ray structures, crystal structures. This is porin, which is what allows small molecules to go inside through the hole. It's called porin because it's a hole. Then here is an example of bacteria rhodopsin from Halobacterium. It's very similar to the visual pigments that we have that give rise to trigger the retinol undergoes a conformational change, and that in turn starts a whole sequence of events. Now, I want to focus for the next 5 minutes on the intracellular domain of the membrane receptor. We talked about the outside, we talked about the overall principles, what governs the signaling inside. We talk about intracellular domain of the membrane receptor. So two mechanisms conduct signal to the inner side of the membrane. One is specific protein-protein interactions. The next protein in the pathway, the effector protein, is activated. So as a consequence of ligand binding, there's some other protein that comes and binds to this protein, and that in turn triggers effector proteins, and you start the cascade. Arrival of the signal triggers enzyme activity in the cytosolic domain, which in turn starts a cascade. The enzyme can be phosphorylation, for example, kinases. Kinases can phosphorylate your protein inside, and that can start a whole cascade of events. And this is something I'll focus on at some length today. So the examples, effector reactions, are activations of G proteins, tyrosine kinases, serine threonine kinases, tyrosine phosphatases, or it can be binding of adapted molecules or opening of ion channels. So if you look at this last event, for example, when you open an ion channel, you never allow one calcium or one sodium, you have a whole influx. You can change concentration from 10 to the minus 7 molar to 10 to the minus 5 molar, okay? And that cascade changes the calcium concentrations, for example, inside, and that gives rise to amplification of events and so forth. So we'll see how we can model that at some level and how we need to think about modeling it, knowing more details of biology. So the active receptor can do all these different types of effector reactions. And sometimes the same receptor can do more than one effector reaction. I'll show you an example of that as well. So the one of the major projects that I'm going to talk about in the next half deals with this set of proteins called G-protein coupled receptors. Now, G-protein coupled receptors, the mechanism of signal transmission, changes in the structure of transmembrane bundle are passed on to cytoplasmic loops. So if something happens at the outside, it changes conformation inside. These loops inside, in turn, communicate with the alpha subunit of a protein called G-protein.
No.
That's the guy here. So something that binds here to the exposed side or changes inside here, And one of the mechanisms that people have know today is, for example, it changes, allows water molecules to come outside or go inside the receptor. For a simple example, it changes the solvation, changes the pKa, and changes changes things outside. Then that in turn changes the conformation of the loops here. And this activates, this communicates with the alpha subunit of G protein, and it exchanges GDP for GTP in the beta gamma subunit of G protein. The moment that happens, it dissociates. So, and once G protein is activated, it dissociates and further does lots of things. So the stages are, see how intricate, the point I want to make for people who are physics modelers is that even a simple event, like the initiation of a signaling event, involves the stages of something binding to outside, this undergoing change, this in turn triggering changes in the conformations here, this in turn binding to proteins that can either change, exchange ligands, and the exchange of ligands in turn dissociates that protein, and that starts the triggering of the event. You see, there are six steps just simply in dealing with the initiation of the signal. So can we model that? So that's an important question. Now, how can you model that? In order to model that, I'd say something like a circuit. Let me think of it as a circuit. If I want to think of it as a circuit, what I need to know is I want to know how much ligand binds here. I want to know how much conformational change happens here. Is there some kind of a stoichiometry and kinetics of this happening? I need to know how long this change is sustained here in terms of going through the conformational change. What is the conformational change? I need to know concentrations of GTP and GTP and GDP. And then I need to know dissociated proteins, how much of beta, gamma, and alpha subunit are there. If I know this, then I can model this as a simple module in a signaling event. Okay? And to do that, I need to measure these quantities. What can I measure? I can measure the ligand, amount of ligand binding, because I can use optical probes, I can use fluorescent markers, I can say this is the concentration of the bound ligand, this is a concentration of the unbound ligand. I can assume that's the measure to some extent of the conformational change here. I can measure the concentration of GDP and GTP at any given instance by using various approaches I'll talk about today. There are ways to do second messenger measurements. When you do that, then you can measure concentration of beta, gamma, and alpha subunit by using combination of 2D gel and mass spec approaches, which is again something I'll talk about today. If you know that, then you can model a simple circuit, assuming there's a feedback of some kind, which you treat like a black box. Today, in fact, there are people like Adam Arkin who have started modeling, and Roger Brent, who model these kinds of circuits using a combination of both stochastic processes and stoichiometric processes, once you know concentrations of these. Now, what is the advantage of doing it? The advantage of doing it is, if I change the concentration of the input, I can ask the question, can I predict what is the quantitatively, what is the concentration change in the beta-gamma subunit or not? And this is a very good example of, starting to think about modeling networks. And John talked yesterday about networks, I assume. So starting to think about, for modeling these networks, you need these details. Yeah. It's different in the following sense. So, it in turn, there is a Michaelis-Menten step involved in, for example, the enzyme activity of going exchanging GDP to GDP. But the overall process is a network which is more complicated than a straightforward.
Yeah.
Well, in 10 millisecond and 100 millisecond events, you don't have intracellular processes taking place. For example, you don't have the dissociation of alpha, beta, gamma. Doesn't happen in the time scale that you're talking about. It happens. Its kinetics are different. Of the module. If you look at the time, correct. Yeah. Yes. You can use effective kinetic models to do that. This is one of the things that people do. Your question is absolutely right. You can model this as effective Michaelis-Menten type approaches. But don't forget, the two things which won't fit into this very well when we talk more is, one is amplification, because that's not easily fittable into a Michaelis-Menten type approach. Okay. I mean, if you can do that, that's good. The second is feedback. And the feedback thing is, for example, downstream. They're quite fast, yeah. Yes. Slow process. Yeah, I agree. So you can model all this. That's why I'm saying modularity in these events. You're actually heading me towards the end of my summarizing of my talk. Modularity is one of the things which we strongly believe happens at various levels, which is why we see across species commonality in processes across tissues, across types. So the goal is, can we model even the submodules and modules like the kind of approaches you're talking about? If we can do that, we are starting taking good steps towards modeling the whole system, or at least approaching the whole system. So you've got a very good point. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm saying you can do that, but you need to, the devil is in the details. So you need to get all the details which happens. Now I talk about G-protein coupled receptors. One of the nice things about G-protein coupled receptors is the events which lead to phosphorylation. Phosphorylation of GPCRs via kinases. Phosphorylation of the receptor takes place in the C-terminal region or in the third cytoplasmic domain. And then this in turn regulates. We talked about one of the regulating mechanisms is this phosphorylation. Phosphorylated receptor can do two things. It can either translocate the protein, or it can arrest the protein and stop the process. So there are these different events. And depending on the concentrations, depending on the location of phosphorylation, depending on the amount of phosphorylation, this feedback occurs. So if you are going to model this in some level of detail, you need to know what is the schism between translocation and arresting. So you need to know that kinetically, which means you need to know what is the rate of this, what's the rate of that. How am I doing on time? Do you guys want to go for a few more minutes before it? Can I do 5 more minutes before we take a break? Is it okay with everybody? So regulatory GTPases. So these proteins, now I want to enter into a realm. I want to talk about one level of complexity which we didn't address so far. When we talk about these proteins like G proteins, which are GTPases, which they turn GTP into GDP, exchange GTP to GDP, there is not just one of them. Every cell has lots of GTPases. Every cell, every tissue has not only there's a lot of GTPases, you've got splice variants, which really means you have multiple exons, and one exon has, you've got multiple possibilities for each protein gene. You've got tissue type variants, isotypes. You've got large numbers of different GTPases which can do the same role, and so forth. A dramatic example of this is that there's one pathway in mouse which is knocked out completely, and the mouse, nothing happened to the mouse. The mouse did exactly the same thing it did with the putative pathway. So it essentially tells you that there's lots and lots of, yeah. ATP is, but GTP is also one of the things. Yeah, but GTP is one of the things. In fact, I'm going to show you, before too long, I'll show you the comparison between the crosstalk between ATP and GTP at this level.
All right.
So these are all molecules.
ATP also provides energy?
It is involved in energy transduction mechanisms. Let's put it that way. More of a signaling thing. ATP is a currency for energy, whereas... Okay, let me tell you. So to tell you what I was saying just now, if you look at superfamily of GTPases, that's a heterotrimeric G proteins. There's proteins called RAS superfamily proteins. There's elongation, initiation, termination factors, and protein biosynthesis. All of this are GTPases. If you look at the end result of what they do, they do the same thing. But where they do it, how they do it, how much they do it, is all dependent very critically upon each of this. So people have worked for many years on really classifying all these G proteins.
If you take a given cell, I think it's natural.
Yeah.
How many of each kind?
Gee, I would like to know that too. That's a good question. This is a very good question. So if you take a given cell, it depends on what tissue it is. It depends upon I'll tell you methods we have on exactly answering that question, but we don't know the answer to this question. Let's look at signaling proteins. If you look at signaling proteins in fly, which is a completely sequenced genome, there's about a few thousand signaling proteins, especially with reference to kinases, phosphorylases, simple serine threonine kinases, tyrosine kinases, phosphorylases, and if you take all these SH2 domains, SH3 domains.
A few thousand signaling GTPases?
No. GTPases are few hundreds. But the point, again, you need to understand is when I talk about these genes, so this is the point you need to appreciate. There are splice variants that are possible. And the splice variants make this a large number. Essentially, does everybody know what a splice variant is? Okay, so if you have, your gene is put together from exons, from various individual exons. So imagine this is your exon 1, 2, 3, etc. Your gene is spliced together. Your RNA is spliced together. You know that DNA goes to RNA, and you go to protein. You know this, right? Okay. Now, in going to RNA, in eukaryotic systems, you have pre-processed RNA and processed RNA. The pre-processed RNA contains introns, exons, and introns. And so if you want to, when you go from exons to introns, there can be multiple copies of these exons. There can be 2 prime, 2 double prime, 2 triple prime, etc. And any of these can get spliced into this. Now what this does is this provides you with immense richness, combinatorial richness for producing diversity, as opposed to having to make these genes separately. Think about the following.
Exon again is the thing that does get transcribed.
Yes, it's the coding part of it. So what I'm saying is there are multiple copies of this. Suppose you want, let me give you a simple example. Imagine you want...
you're saying there's a family of proteins that have the same part 1 and part 3.
Exactly. And it can even have combinatorics. So part 1 and part 3 can have 5 possibilities. Part 2 can have 10 possibilities. So immediately the number of genes you can construct out of this is 5 times 5 times 3. In fact, your entire immune system diversity is produced by this mechanism. Okay, you're not going to make 10 to the 9 antibodies. You don't have 10 to the 9 genes that you have. So the way you accomplish it is you just simply have variation in individual exons, multiple copies of that. So you produce combinatorial explosion of number of things that can happen. So what I'm trying to point out is, in addition to everything else, you have this complexity to worry about in terms of what people have started to, when you parse the genome, when you say there are 39,000 genes in the human genome, it doesn't mean it includes all possible splice variants. Okay? So this is something, that is just simply way too large to deal with. And this can depend upon the context, it can depend upon regulation, it can depend upon feedback, and so forth. So one of the goals, I'm going to talk about this in the late second part of my talk, one of the goals is if you want to ask this simple question, if I get a protein in a cell from my microarray experiment, can I detect it because it's a splice variant or not? Okay? So this is an important question to deal with. In addition to mutant species, in addition to natural variations and all that stuff, there's also splice variation, there's also variation on tissue types, isotypes, and so forth. So the point I want to make here is that this is where the sequence level information interacts with the cell level biology, which is you can have variation in the sequence, which can give rise to variation in the mechanism of biology that happens. Well, you have this, think of this as the following. You have all these options. But look, we're not talking about somatic mutations. I'm talking about the fact that you have these different splice variants possible. The somatic mutation is on top of that.
Okay.
So I'm talking about just the fact that these things, multiple possibilities exist.
No.
Yes. 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 That's correct. Yeah. So all I'm saying is the sequence level interaction changes, in fact, what happens at this level of complexity. And again, the modeling of the sequence is something that people do routinely. Let me try to say one more thing before I stop. So here's an example of another process. So if you have signal, light, odor, taste, hormones, glucagon, etc. Now this can give rise to a number of processes. It can become active, it can become inactive. When it becomes active, you can have all these different effector molecules. And this is how heterotrimeric G proteins work. So our goal is, see, as biologists who are trying to find effective processes, what we're trying to do is we're trying to take the whole gamut of things, asking, can we classify, can we categorize, can we reduce? This is the question that was raised earlier. Can we reduce it to something that we can say that this whole thing belongs to this family, this belongs to this family, this belongs to the other family? This is what we're trying to do here. For example, if you take the effector molecules, there's adenylyl cyclase, there's phospholipase, there's potassium channels, and beta adrenergic receptor kinase, BART kinase. So we're trying to ask the question, can we try to reduce it, guys? It's too complicated. So this is the question that we're asking. So can we try to break this down into modules of some kind, special molecules of some kind, and so forth? In the next half of my talk, I'll tell you about methods we're trying to use in order to do this. I have a lot more stuff which I can't cover here effectively. The only point I want to make is about second messengers. To give you an example, what are second messengers? So when you have, when something binds, it starts releasing these molecules which can in turn go and as messengers and go and communicate. These are calcium and IP3 and so forth. To give you an example of a simple second messenger molecule, inositol triphosphate, it goes through this cycle. Now, this is a picture, no doubt, but people have measured intermediates. They've measured phosphatidyl inositol kinase, inositol phosphokinase, PLC. They've measured these intermediate concentrations, so we know that this is a module. And this cycle, essentially, what it does is it goes from inositol to CMP, and here it gives rise to these different things. These are intracellular signal transduction molecules. So I'm saying that there are our goal of this whole thing is, can we reduce this details and complexity of all these different reactions into sets of modules that we can start then modeling at some level of detail, either using Michaelis-Menten for kinetics or just stoichiometry or just topology of network and so forth. So in the second half of what I'm going to talk, I'll tell you the methods we are planning to take, how to do this stuff effectively. Where is the drawback? The drawback is there's no consistent data today. If you look at literature data, there's literature data measured by John Doe and John Adams, some different people. They're all done under different conditions. They're all done with different cell types. They're done with different concentrations. There's no consistency and uniformity of data. So what I would like to talk about next half is how this Alliance for Cell Signaling is expecting to generate large volumes of data, which will give rise to the potential for modeling, and tell you what are the types of modeling that we are anticipating doing, and this is what I would like to do. So this is the first enzyme. The second enzyme, you can look at the order of magnitude difference, 10 to the minus 43 and 10 to the minus 24. This is uridyl transferase. It's a p-value, yeah, score. But it's calculated using the statistics of just motif-based alignment. And this is the value for 10 to the minus 48 and 10 to the minus 22. So you can see that clearly in this case, we experimentally then isolated these genes, and they turned out to be the right genes, and they have been annotated now and so forth. So all I'm saying is we can that what I showed you was computational, but we went to the lab. This company which is collaborating with us went to the lab, took Vibrio cholerae, took the genes, and then they showed that this mechanism exists. They isolated the genes using this chip. They constructed a chip, they designed, then they ran the genes through this, and then and galactose metabolism. They identified, they isolated the genes and sequenced them. So the point I'm trying to make here is that this technology can be, we are extending it now to signaling genes. We are trying to find out these motifs for signaling genes. We are going to make an array with those, and we can run. If I put adrenaline inside my cell, now I can ask the question, which are the proteins that are invoked in this process? And you don't have to do one or two. You can do hundreds of thousands of these motifs on a chip. The second approach I told you about is proteomics approach. The first is to measure what genes are present. And we want to use this affymetrix array, cDNA array, and the motif array to measure that. So at the end of that, what we will know is we'll know how many genes, what are the proteins present in a given cell type, for example. This is answered Terry Waugh's question that he asked me in the previous session. You asked me, can we know how many signaling genes are present in a given cell? So at that point, we can find it. The second question is the proteomics question. How many of these things are really expressed under any given condition? So it's the question that we need to So the approach we are taking is a combination of 2D gel and mass spec. There are lots of, I'll give you an example here from Matthias Mann's work, where he isolated a new protein using proteomics approaches. So I want to tell you how we plan to go about doing this. So this is using mass spec. So the way it's done is very simple. The way it's done is you take a cell at any given condition, lyse the cell, you do a 2D gel, you get all the phosphoproteins, and then you cut, and we have robotics technology where you can cut that spot. You can go through the purification process, put it into mass spec, and out comes the sequence of this protein. Once you get the sequence, then fragments, so fragment masses, then you go back and fit it to your database and then find out what protein it is. Then you have that, you know, that's the protein. You can also get quantitative values. You can get what is the concentration of this and the number of copies that you're going to get. Sorry? Exactly. Sorry? Well, I mean, this is a very good question because it depends upon your mass spec. There are, now they claim that, you know, picomolar amounts and femtomolar amounts are sufficient in mass spec to do this. So essentially you'll need, it depends upon what concentrations you're looking at. So people have, one of the things that Rudy Ebersol at Seattle is looking at is trying to ask this exact question, what is the minimal amount of material that you can detect? And if you've got only 10 transcript copies, you're not going to be able to detect it. You're going to miss it. Clearly, that's one of the limitations of this method. If you've got thousands of molecules, you're going to detect it. Sorry? Now, these are protein sequences, and essentially, they can be anywhere between 50, 60 amino acids, like small domains, all the way up to hundreds of amino acids, or thousands of amino acids. So mass spec today can deal with that very well. 2D gel is just to identify what are the phosphoproteins, for example, or to find the right kind of proteins that are involved in the signaling event. And well, the technology for 2D gel is a little complicated. I mean, it's not that difficult. You just use electrophoresis technology combined with, you can use combination of gravity. You can do it by charge and by flow of mass, by molecular weight. Those are two things. Or you can do it by charge and phosphorylation. You can look at antibodies which specifically bind to those phosphorylated molecules. Exactly. Once you get these proteins, then you can just simply cut that spot out and then do mass spec. It can look for all kinds of serine phosphorylations. It can look for threonine, tyrosine phosphorylations, and so forth. So once you go to mass spec, it breaks it down into small fragments. So you want to piece these fragments back together. When you piece them back together, you can, corresponding to a given mass fragment pattern, you've got a well-defined sequence. It's a one-to-one map. You can actually show that. And there are people like Pavel Pevsner who work on the algorithms for going back from one to the other. So this is the second approach we're taking. So what we hope to do, we are planning to get something like about 200 or so 2D gels a week, where we'll end up doing this for a given input. Let's say we input 50 millimolar catecholamine into the, or not, adrenaline or epinephrine into the cell. We ask the question, what are the proteins at time t equals 5 seconds, t equals 10 seconds, t equals 30 seconds, t equals 2 minutes, 5 minutes. We can ask the question, what is the, I can do 2D gels, I can freeze the cell, cut the cell, do the experiment at that time, 2D gel experiment, take the proteins, do a mass spec, come back and find the sequence, and ask the question, what is the protein that's present at a given time? Yeah.
Two things I wonder about. You're probably not applying any of these techniques to single cells.
No.
And if you're not, how then are you going to synchronize the population?
I'm going to answer the question right now, in fact. I will do that. So one of the nice things about these experiments, this alliance for cell signaling, is that we are creating homogeneous populations of these cells. The two cell types we are looking at for starters are cardiac myocyte and B lymphocyte. And we can create highly homogeneous populations of these cells. In fact, we are not considering them in vivo. This is the other thing you need to understand. We are not studying them in the real physiology. We are looking at them. We are looking at the phenotype in physiology, but we are looking at these cells isolated. So we are isolating B cells, which are, about 10 to the 9. We can't do it in the body. So therefore, we're not doing it in the body. We are doing it actually in vitro, which is you're just taking this, isolating these populations of these cells. Now you ask the second question, which is, this is the earlier comment I made. How homogeneous are these cell populations? And we want to test for homogeneity of various kinds of markers. Assuming even that we have a homogeneous population, we still have the ergodic hypothesis question that I addressed before, which is not all cells will behave in the same way.
Genetically homogeneous?
I'm talking about homogeneous in terms of cell genotype. That's exactly what I'm talking about. So the question you're asking is, how do we know that...
By 100, by 10,000 cells in the experiment,
yeah.
How do I know that they were all at the same point in, for instance?
We don't know. So we are hoping that there will be sufficient population of these cells which will be in the same state so that we'll be able to measure these things. You are absolutely right. We don't know the answer to that.
It's not hard to synchronize. Right, but tradition, I mean, there are a lot of methods to do that.
Yes, yes, yes. Correct. You don't want, exactly, yeah. You have a point. No, this is, we're trying to use some method to synchronize it, but we don't want to perturb the cell. So this trade-off has to, exactly. The argument here is we want to get, capture the middle of the Boltzmann distribution. So if we capture the middle of the Boltzmann population, then we'll be in good shape. So that's, yeah.
I'm a little confused. So the statement is that in mass spec, you can actually detect
No. The phosphorylation you can detect from the 2D gel itself, you can determine the state of phosphorylation. You get a different spot. So what mass spec does is to help you get the sequence of the protein, what protein it is, and what quantity it is in.
Okay, and because in the signaling cascade, I would imagine it's only a very small fraction of the enzyme which will get activated. So let's say 1%.
Right.
So you'll have to detect the phosphorylation of 1% of that people.
Right. So the point we are doing is we're not taking one cell. So that's why this is the answer to his question too. We're taking 10 to the 9 cells. Yeah.
That doesn't still obviously help, right? You still...
No, if you take it to the 9 cells and you assume...
The question is what is the sensitivity of the experiment?
How much concentration do you have of the protein? That's the question that you're asking.
Well, I don't think concentration is the number.
Right. If you have 10 to the 9 cells and one copy of the protein per cell, can you see that?
That's 10 to the 9. This is what I'm saying. That's already into the regime of between femtomolar and picomolar. So you can do that. This is the point I'm trying to say. So between femtomolar and picomolar, you can make, today with the technology, you can do, picomolar is really doable. I mean, femtomolar is questionable. Picomolar is 10 to the 23 is Avogadro number. So if you've got 10 to the 9 cells, if you take it to the 9 times, 10 to the, so essentially, if you get one transcript per cell, then you have already picomolar concentration. So that's the point I'm saying.
Yeah.
Oh, this is the point. So in the 2D gel, you're only picking up phosphorylated molecules. This is the point I made before. So you're isolating these different spots. You got...
Because they have different charge, they will not end up next to each other.
That's the point. So let me, in fact, show you that. In fact, I may have something which shows that, in fact. Let me see if I have that. I'm sorry, I had it somewhere else, but I didn't show it. But essentially what I'm saying is that it'll be in different locations on your XY coordinate on the 2D gel, since it's in different locations.
Really different locations.
Sometimes there'll be overlaps, no doubt about that. But that's the kind of issues we need to sort out.
Are these small shifts?
Yeah.
Are small shift on the large
dot
scale
or the
antibody?
Yeah. It's
not going to pick up something else. So that's the point. Exactly.
So then you have a spot.
Exactly.
He just wants the sequence. So you run this thing out, right? You've got a band, and there's a ton of protein there. It's all the same. It's not as phosphorylated, it's not.
Yeah.
Okay, so
Right. But the antibody uses this 2D. One of the factors is the antibody-based approach to doing gel electrophoresis. Where am I here? Okay. So the third approach for doing this is just sequence homology. Even when you do mass spec, we need to really identify what protein it is. So it's sequence homology-based approaches. I don't have time to talk at great length about this, but this I can give a talk, entire talk on both my lab's work and other people's work on really the issues dealing with sequence homology. What sorts of alignments, algorithms used, scoring schemes, and gap penalties, and so forth. So this is a very complex problem, and many people work on this area of research. We have created for the Alliance a pipeline. What the pipeline does is you put in a sequence, it goes through a global alignment of various kinds, it annotates wherever it's available. If it doesn't hit anything, it goes to local alignments, motifs of various kinds. It goes to about a whole slew of algorithms, and then finally everything else that's not annotated is left alone and for future reference. So this pipeline does run all the time. Function annotation. So we have this pipeline running all the time. It's public. It's available to everybody who wants it. One of the examples of a signaling protein that we found by using this pipeline is we found in the organism C. elegans, we found a protein that binds to TGF-beta receptor binding domain of a protein. We used this sequence, local sequence homology-based approaches, and now it's been, we published this, and then subsequently somebody actually isolated the gene, cloned and expressed it, and this is an important, therapeutically important gene. It's a TGF-beta receptor binding gene. This is the type of things. You know, you may not have large amounts of homology in one domain. In this domain, we have significant homology for local regions. In this domain, there's not a whole lot of homology, but these sensitive techniques pick up this. And people like, I mean, physicists know hidden Markov models and all that stuff, so there's lots of good techniques used today to do this. The second question we want to ask is, who talks to whom? We know first who are the players, who talks to whom. So what we want to do is we want to create a very large list of interacting molecule partners, detect all of the physical interactions among relevant components, and then perform bioinformatics analysis. This is the game plan. So there are two very good techniques we want to use. The first technique is a spectacular technique called the yeast 2 hybrid method. The idea is very simple. Yeast cells, whenever you want to express a protein, you know, you've got to have promoter binding regions. You've got a binding domain and an activation domain. If you take your PK, if you think A and B talk to each other, you take, or B and P talk to each other, you take B and then you hook onto it a binding domain, you take the other protein, hook onto it, the DNA, I mean, the DNA level, you hook on the activation domain, you co-express these things in the yeast cell. The only time they'll talk to each other is if these two proteins interact, then the activating domain, activation domain, and binding domain come together. When they come together, the expression of the reporter gene gets started, and this is a spectacular technology, high throughput technology. So using this, for example, people with yeast biology, Peter Yates published his paper, He published a paper where he took 6,000 yeast transformations and he essentially found 2,000 odd interactions between these different proteins. So this is, they can be done in a high throughput mode or a low throughput mode. So we are using this technology now. We have a contract with Myriad, which is going to do for us 200 of these kinds of experiments every week. Not very high. But the point is we'll independently validate it. So the first way is to do this yeast 2 hybrid approach at the gene level. Then at the protein level, we are making antibodies. We are making antibodies for every signaling protein that we identified. So now we can do co-immunoprecipitations. That means inside the cell, we can ask the question, who is precipitated at the same time? So that is the second approach. We are combining all this. David Eisenberg had combined all these approaches, experimental data and phylogeny and all this stuff, and one of the things we're exploring is how to use this kind of an approach, combined approach. Complication is the following, the yeast 2 hybrid method that you pointed out, this is actually derived from yeast 2 hybrid and other methods. A single protein interacts with all these guys. Does it make sense? It doesn't make sense for a given pathway because that's just too many. So we want to know who is really significant player and who is a random player. So this is the kind of question that we need to sort out. So the third question we want to ask is, what are the pathways invoked? So this is a very important component of the AFCS Alliance for Cell Signaling work. We want to determine responses to inputs and interacting combinations of inputs while altering functional concentrations of signaling components. Essentially, we want to ask the question, if I have an input, if I change the concentration of the input, how will it change the signaling response? And we want to do it in single and in combinations of inputs. And we want to establish and verify connectivity between molecules using genetic, biochemical, and pharmacological perturbations. So this is the reason why we have large collaboration with industry too. The example molecules, we have about 150 molecules, signaling molecules, we want something like 100 molecules we want to look at. These are proteins, peptides, amino acids, nucleotides, retinoids, and so forth. let's talk about a pathway. So once we get a pathway, so this is an example of cyclic AMP signaling pathway. So simple, what we know so far, canonical stuff. This is all the stuff that goes on. Imagine, we don't know a lot of missing pieces. In between, there's bound to be a lot of missing pieces. Are we ever going to be able to model a network like this? My answer is, this is probably not relevant. It's not necessary to model. So in my lab, we are thinking about the following strategy. In fact, I would like to solicit help for doing this. If you think of the signaling event, let me give you an example of what we want to think about it as. If you think of a signaling event as a network like this, okay, don't worry about who are the players. Talk about the movement of signal from point 1 to 2 to 3 to 4, 5, etc. Can I now model this network by trying to use constraints between 1 to 2, 2 to 3, and the constraints are in the form of concentrations of protein-protein interactions, concentration of second messengers, and phosphorylation, phosphorylation and dephosphorylation stoichiometries. So essentially, I want to use constraints to ask the question, how much signal goes from point 1 to 2 to 3, and so I can construct a network of signal moving from various places, the flux of the signal. Yeah. Well, the metabolic control life is, yes, metabolic control life is much simpler. Because you have a linear pathway, I mean, A converts, substrate goes to B, B substrate goes to C, etc. Here you have all kinds of crosstalk, everything going on. So what I would like to really do is ask a simple question.
There's something about flux in and out.
Exactly, flux in and out. And they want to model the first level, as you said, the network of the flux, and ask the question, if I knock out one gene in that flux, what happens to the network? Does the network gets converted into in a space which is really...
There are loops in the network.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah.
Then something will happen for a time,
No question about it. So the loops will work as constraints in this first network modeling approach. For example, going from signal flux from position from 5 to 6, I have this phosphoinositol cycle that I talked to you about, which has got a feedback. So I can say that this is the relative concentration of these two, or this is the time when it has a feedback here, otherwise you go off into this branching point here.
But you
yeah.
Exactly.
The idea is modularity again. The idea is not so much worrying about the stochastic nature of this whole process. The idea is just look at modularity. We have all these experimental constraints. We are going to get this for the cell type. So we want to use those constraints to build a network topology. What? Sorry?
How do you define the model?
Define a model. It's got a well-defined input and well-defined output. So that's because then we can model that as an individual, as a local event.
One important question.
Yeah.
I don't know of very many examples where the differential equation and stochastic modeling type approach has given very useful answers.
Correct.
Absolutely.
In fact, in metabolic, this is the point that you referred to. There are at least a few extremely well-defined experimental computational approaches where people have looked at metabolism. But not Paulson in my department does that kind of stuff. He took, for example, E. coli model. He asked the question: if I change glycerol concentrations in the input or put a medium which is different in this concentration.
But if anything is the first order of bag of chemical, E. coli is
yes. Yes. Yeah. Sorry. Eukaryotes are not. But the difference here in the eukaryotes is you have more constraints. We are not really worrying about genotype-phenotype relation. This is the reason why I was very careful in saying I'm not modeling the whole relationship between genotype and phenotype. All I'm asking is a simple question. If I change the concentration at one level...
A
useful model is not necessarily the same as the final answer.
Right.
And there's certainly... trying to figure out what kind of initial models you can use the available data
Now, where it's, I think it's going to help a lot is in the following way. Suppose I construct these sets of modules and I build a pathway. I can ask how I can coarse grain this. I can ask how I can coarse grain, because I can say that this, I've got 25 modules in my network, or 25 sub-modules in my network. I can say that 4, 5, and 6 can have these alternate different types of approaches. So I can really convert that into a coarse-grained approach. That will answer the other question I started by saying, different inputs give rise to the same response. So that means there must be something common about the way it's going about doing things. So I can...
Do you need to wait until you get the high-quality data before trying this approach?
There's almost no data now. So that's the problem. We don't even know who's missing. With this thing, with this approach, with this experimental approach, we are going to find
as complete a path as possible.
So one of the challenges in doing this is actually to create a database infrastructure for doing it. And we have, in my lab, worked on building this database infrastructure. We have this pathways, we have this GUI for doing this, which actually I can dynamically alter the pathway. I can ask the question, how is it changing? What are the genes that are changing in this? It can go to experimental data and ask about, if I change this pathway in such a way, can I look at changes in expression profiles, proteomics, or interaction profiles coming from here? And then this feeds back into this, and then it goes and looks at all these different analysis options that I have. So we're building such an infrastructure. Oh, everything we do is freely available. All the data, all the databases. In fact, already we have lots of data in dealing with this. Now, let me conclude in the last 5 minutes in talking about why it's a complicated problem for us to do this. I'm sorry, I missed John. John, I talked about at length about network modeling before and how we plan to go about doing it, but you know the stuff in any case. So the bioinformatics problem prior to getting to the network problem is actually trying to get these different data collections and representations are too problem specific. We need to try to make them, often this data cannot be integrated by direct joins. We have semantics which is not explicitly modeled in the data. Things like, you know, genes. All of us think we understand what is a gene, but a gene definition in a eukaryote and a prokaryote is different. They refer to slightly different objects. In one case, you have a promoter region embedded into it. So these are things which people, only semantics has to be taken into account at some level. Then we have all this different data, this time-dependent data, this volume data, this image series data, and so forth. So it's very complicated. So we have created this pipeline. I don't want to talk about all these different issues, so we have considered all of these different issues and how do we deal with legacy data at this point in time, how do we deal with high throughput data. Automation is the key to this. How do we deal with tools and applications in combination with this? So integration, how do we integrate these things? And finally, what types of user interfaces and tools we need to build? So we're working on all these devils in the details kind of things. So. End of a few years, we took the following approach for integration of data. So we took a mediation approach. There is monolithic approach, create one single thing, but obviously nobody is going to follow one religion, so this is not something which is good. Digital library approach is every solution is a different collection, and you have feedback. You essentially have a wrapper which wraps up each of these collections, and this is very tedious. And the mediation approach is we are designing middlewares which combines different sources, and we have a relational database that actually does that using XML. So much of what we do today, all the data that's coming from the labs, different labs, we are really doing converting it from native XML database into an Oracle database. And from the Oracle, we are doing different SQLs and analysis tool building that can go and talk back to the user interface. So we have a huge engineering challenge. So essentially, if you're a biologist, you want to do all these different types of things. If you're a computer scientist, what you need to do is you need to create a single interface, computer platform independence. You want to have total opaqueness to format differences, whether you give a sequence in this format or data in this format. Microarray data, for example, comes in 6 different formats. Can we have some common way of integrating that? And you're not going to be able to tell MIT to generate in a given format as compared to Stanford. So we need to just integrate those. And then we need to have seamless access to files, file uploads, downloads. In fact, we have built something like this in the past, which is freely available to the community. It's called the Biology Workbench. And it's in fact totally freely available. Today, there's about 40,000 users a day on the average. And so you can use it to do sequence analysis. It doesn't do pathway analysis. So what we're doing now is to build on top of this to do all this pathway analysis and modeling. I think I should skip all of this stuff. So let me skip this. Let me stop here at this point and then I'll summarize what I said so far. So the the point of what I'm trying to say is that we are going to end up getting enormous amounts of data that deal with analysis of cell signaling in two types. At the end of 5 years, we want to have a map of all the different pathways, all the different modules, all the different correlations of inputs, and so forth. Now, the next question challenge is, how do we take all of this and build models, mathematical models, or quantitatively predicting models? And I started telling you about this. One of the approaches we are taking is first to build topological networks of these models. And from the topology, we can at least say, gee, this is a good starting point for building quantitative stochastic modeling or any other kind of modeling at this point. Unfortunately, the devil is really in the details in this. We need to really build, worry about all the details, coarse grain successively as we go along and complete this model building. So we will make every piece of this data available online on time. You know, we are not going to do any analysis prior to making it available to the community. So the current game plan is, it's already started happening. If you go to www.cellularsignaling.org, that's the website for our AFCS, you'll get all the data that's coming from microarray labs, 2D gel data, and East2 hybrid data. All of that gets automatically put into this. I mean, raw data comes into us. We can make raw data available, or we can put it into our Oracle database, XML Oracle database structure, and we make that available to you. So you can use it in any way you want. We want to make analysis tools available. We won't be able to provide you with extensive amount of time for doing all the analysis on your own. If you want to bring your own data and do analysis in combination with that, you'll have to do it in-house till we actually get the computational infrastructure in place. But at least we'll provide you all the data and all the simple analysis of our results. What we do, we'll show automated analysis, we'll show, make it available to you. And everything is totally free to pharmaceutical companies. There's no intellectual property attached to this. This is a new paradigm. There's zero intellectual property content. Everything we do is totally public. And every piece of data we are going to put in the public domain. What I would really like to do is, I come from physics background to some extent, so I want to think about this problem as not just modeling analytical things, but modeling data to build a system where we can model, get an analytical approaches. So that's where I am. I mean, my whole lab is focused on really trying to model the data, make sense of the data. And this data actually is very heterogeneous. It's got, I mean, if you look at signaling, it looks like things like such a thing activates it 50% or activates it so much and deregulates it so much. And I mean, that's kind of vague. That's linguistic stuff. It's not modelable stuff. So we need to convert it into something more concrete. This is one of the goals of what we are trying to do. We're trying to convert qualitative biological description into some quantitative approaches where you can analyze the data. So building a network is the first step in the direction for these things. Terry. So all the trial stuff is now going on, meaning that we're starting to get a lot of data from L. Simon's lab dealing with microarrays. We're getting data from Dallas dealing with, 2D gels. And we are testing how well we can make it visible, available, and so forth. So in the next 4 weeks to 6 weeks, we anticipate mass production. And then the data will be streaming in and so forth. No. They are just testing at the trial phase. Accumulation of data will be coincident with the release of data. So on a 24-hour basis, the data comes in from various labs to the central, UCSD is where all the, bioinformatics core is. So we'll get all the data. We are creating the infrastructure for making it available to the community at large.
Now, to some extent, you'll have lots of experimental protocols.
Yes. Let me show you that. In fact, that's exactly what we're doing. So I skipped that actually. Oh, it's off. It's all right. It's okay. Yeah. So essentially, we have microarray data coming from Caltech. We have proteomics data coming from Dallas. We have genomic data, genetic data coming from UC San Francisco. We have the microscopy data coming from Stanford.
And they will all be following the same experimental protocol.
Exactly. So we are setting up a barcode system. So the barcode system will precisely tell us exactly what is the approach we are taking to, what sample is being dealt with and what conditions under which it is being dealt with.
The experimental preparation will be in different labs.
Right.
Yeah.
different lab techniques are consistent.
That's exactly what we're doing now. So in fact, all these different labs, I don't have that figure. I had a figure which showed actually how these things, that data is coming in. We are standardizing not only the data, we're standardizing the experimental protocols.
Yeah.
I have two statisticians whose job is essentially to standardize experimental protocols for doing these things. And we have a barcode system universal across these different labs, so there'll be very well-defined definition samples. We're testing samples. We're doing 2D gels in two different places, two different labs for the same cell type distributed. We want to make sure we get exactly the same type of results. And so this is the reason why I said it's a good project, because we are going to hopefully get consistent set of data. And all this is going on right now as we speak. This is the process we are currently doing. In the end of 4 to 6 weeks, we'll have start releasing this data. I mean, start getting this. There are 50 odd labs, but they include all the not only the core. The core, I'm talking about the core labs. These are the core labs. Mass production is done in these core labs. Peripheral experiments will be done in this, all these affiliated labs and so forth. The mass production is just essentially these labs I told you. And the goal of this is at the end of this, we'll have consistent set of data for the community to start analysis, to start doing various things. And we build maps, pathway maps out of these.
Would there be a way to couple maps? Suppose somebody does some modeling, make a prediction?
Yes, you can add. We absolutely welcome Alliance members who will do models, who will feedback. In fact, when Adam and John model these pathways, it goes back and triggers more experiments. We have N different ways of validation of experiments, model validation. One is we are talking about doing experimental validation by knockout experiments of various kinds, by doing RNA interference experiments. And so there's a whole slew of setup of experiments we apply and plan for validating the models. This is the first five-year phase. Then we are hoping, this is NIH told us that there'll be 2 5-year phases depending upon the progress made in the first five-year phase. Then the second level, we'll be able to do more quantitative modeling in a more significant way. Essentially, we are data gatherers for doing consistent kind of sets and organizers and building tools for modeling the data. But the first, I mean, essentially, well, I tried to do the following. The first half of my talk, I talked about the complexity in dealing with signaling. In the second half of my talk, I talked about how we are generating data that will be helpful for doing this modeling. I didn't mean to make people upset or angry or anything. There's a gentleman here who seemed to have gotten very upset about being biologists being denigrated. There's no intention to denigrate anybody. Yeah. It was just a way of saying that, look, you know, these are really things that people need to think about. Yeah. And, so,